This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Tom Sisti. Tom is the Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. Tom has an extensive background, career in procurement. He worked on the Hill for the Senate Government Affairs Committee and was lead counsel for the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act, one of my favorite pieces of legislation. He writes frequently on government procurement issues and is very active in, you know, procurement policy through various trade associations. He's a member of the Board of Advisors at the Coalition for Government Procurement and also one of our the co-chairs of the coalition's GWAC, MAC, and Enterprise Contracting Committee. So, Tom, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Roger. Good morning.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our discussion. You know, it's always fun to talk procurement, and that leads to my first question. Why procurement? Why does procurement matter?
Well, I think procurement matters because it really is, it's sort of the unspoken but important critical part of making government work efficiently. You know, people think that, you know, you always go into something or you do something because it'll have some tremendous meaning in the world. You're not gonna cure cancer with procurement, but you may help cure cancer with procurement. And that's the critical thing, especially at a time where you have budget constraints and other challenges in the country. You need a system that works efficiently, effectively, brings goods and services to those who serve citizens in a timely way so that they can meet the needs of the nation.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Tom. And you know, it's funny how your careers go, but I sort of, you know, came to Washington, interviewed at a bunch of different agencies, and ended up at GSA. And you know, I'm glad I did from the perspective of I got to work in procurement. Mm-hmm. And to your point, it does touch every mission that government, you know, engages in some manner or other. The procurement system, you know, provides either the services or the products that people use to accomplish those missions.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I think if you look at both people in the private sector and the public sector, even, you have people who have at some point worked in both fields. They either started out in government and then went to the private sector, or vice versa, or they've circled back and forth. And that's what's interesting about the procurement community, because it is a self-refreshing kind of system where there's a lot of collaboration, a lot of mind share around how to do things better. You know, oftentimes you hear of government contractors, and they say think of them as a separate entity. But, you know, we don't recognize what I think Steve Schooner said over at GW, that we have government contractors in war zones. We have these people have been side to side with our great soldiers trying to protect this country, and they've suffered casualties just as our soldiers have suffered. So it's important to remember that there's not this bright line or this big wall separating these two communities. These communities work hand in hand, and it's all focused on making things better for the country.
Right, and we're in, you know, violent agreement today, Tom. But it seems to me that the ability to work both in the private sector and then in government, or vice versa, I that enhances the system, in my view. But you got to get a better perspective. Like I like to say, you know, when I went to the private sector, if I had known, you know, now in the private sector what I knew as government, I would have done things a little bit differently to make the system as more efficient. So, and that's part of what I try to do in my life now in terms of, you know, talking about where we should go with regard to procurement policy.
Well, I think that's true. It's more than this philosophical notion of walking in somebody else's shoes. This is a reality. You don't know the pressures or constraints of people executing deals. Simply putting together a non-disclosure agreement or a teaming agreement, what the implications are for companies when they put that together. On the other side, I think there has to be a sensitivity for the private sector of the real mission of the agencies and what underlies all government acquisition, which is that you're protecting the public fisc. There are certain things the government does that don't translate readily to the private sector environment, that the government has an obligation in addition to all of its other functions of making sure that money is well spent, it's safeguarded, and that a mission is seen through to completion.
Yeah. Well, I now want to focus a little bit on, procurement policy. And first of all, let's just take back to your time on the Hill and when you were lead counsel for the and Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, working on the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act. And, the 90s were a period of, people look at it as reform, streamlining the acquisition process, commercial item acquisition, commercial item contracting. What was going on then and why the focus on the reforms?
Well, I think when you look back, you can almost think of it as a flash cut, but it really wasn't. Acquisition reform was an evolutionary process. You have to remember that there were so many different commissions going back into the last century, way back into the last century, and they were pulled together, the Packard Commission, all of those. But they all came up with common themes, and that kind of built up a pressure. Some of the themes were, identifying and increasing the use of best business practices. Thinking about a strong and coordinated management for acquisition, simplification, centralization of procurement laws and regs. You remember SECA?
Right.
We had a federal acquisition regulation as opposed to two separate major regulations. Professional development for the acquisition corps was really recognizing that acquisition in and of itself is a complex process and needs some focus, needs attention, and the people who work in that field need support. And of course, increasing the use of competition because that tends to drive people towards improvement and certainly drives down prices. The increased use of commercial practices generally. You can remember all the ashtray TV segments and everything. Yeah. And then using commercial items where you can. And, just reducing government unique specifications in that regard. Because, if you have a private sector that's expending money on innovation and research and development, the government doesn't need to spend that money again to do it for itself if it can leverage those commercial items. You have to make a determination up front, I think, that, we can use a commercial item here to suit our purposes, and then you free up those funds for reinvestment in things that are government unique, say weapons systems and things like that. So I think that's where you kind of start. And then you go into the Section 800 panel. That was an outgrowth of the FY91 Defense Authorization Act, and it was just a mandate for DOD, the government generally, to review all the procurement laws and make recommendations for repeal or amendment. It was, I think it was close to 2,000 pages, maybe, that report. And it ended up focusing on having DOD act like a commercial buyer, simplify procedures for low-dollar procurements, adjust socioeconomic thresholds, and really adjust a threshold for below which TINA would not, Truth in Negotiations Act, would not apply. Well, that sort of vectored into the National Performance Review, which was led by Vice President Gore. It looked at procurement, had similar recommendations to those of the Section 800 panel, and it sort of highlighted the fact that the world has to change because in procurement, because the world generally has changed. We're seeing the end of the Cold War. We saw the development of a strong, competitive global base, industrial base. And so it's sought to streamline based on the use of technology and to vest, I think, the acquisition professionals and program people generally with discretion, which would be motivated in a sense by their self-interest, not personal gain self-interest, but self-interest for their programs. And so, but you really have to focus back at that time on 1994, where you had the mandate for change. That came out of Secretary of Defense Perry's office. And we knew, based on that mandate for change, that there was going to be a decline in spending for defense products because of the peace dividend.
Right.
Little did we know what would follow a decade later. But DOD was also struggling to acquire state-of-the-art commercial technology. You have to remember, CAS, cost accounting standards, is not resident in a lot of commercial companies. You had increased costs associated with government unique terms and conditions, and there was concern over the government accessing proprietary data. You know, just think about that. I mean, we sort of have those concerns right now in a different format, which we can talk about.
Right, but yeah, and we will do that when we come back from a break, Tom. But right now, we do have to take a break. My guest today is Tom Sisti. He is Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, and we're talking acquisition policy, procurement reform, and we'll continue that discussion when we come back. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, and we've been talking a little procurement history, so to speak, right, Tom? A little bit about the 1990s and the reform movement and streamlining acquisition. And you were talking a little bit about FASA and what was going on there, you know, and just to put the context for the listeners here, this is important because I believe it's important, and obviously the listeners can decide if they think it's important, but it's important because, to me, you know, we're at the same sort of juncture in terms of, you know, the system and the folks who work in the system, I think, are really looking for how it can be more efficient, more effective, and provide best value for the taxpayer. You know, with the backdrop of the fiscal challenges we face, and I know there's a recent, actually, Deloitte report on management of government, and one of the things that it actually identified is acquisition is currently considered the least efficient, you know, element of the management system out there. So, this is important because in the 90s, there's efforts to make this system more efficient, more effective, rely on the commercial marketplace, reform IT acquisition, and we're sort of at the same, starting to get sort of at the same place where people are thinking about it. That's my view.
Well, it's not, you're right, it's not just a walk down memory lane for two balding middle-aged fat guys. I mean, it's just, it's...
speak for yourself there, Tom. Okay.
It's, you do...
Yeah. My picture, our pictures are up on the website, okay?
You know, you've got... You really have to think about the time. I mean, we're hitting a point where we can't do business the way we've been doing it because we do have a lot of sand in the gearbox, so to speak. And in that sense, there's some similarity back. You know, DOD could not continue. The government could not continue doing business the way it was doing it back then. So with FASA, you had the repeal of about 225 provisions in law, sought to reduce paperwork, to simplify the purchase of commercial items, to enhance, simplify procedures for small businesses, focus on efforts in electronic commerce, and to improve the efficiency of the laws governing the system overall. Now, you know, there are other things that were done. There was a uniformity established, but it also facilitated multiple award task and delivery order contracts. And that's, you know, interestingly enough, is sort of what we're confronting today. Remember, there were just different perspectives on the multiple award task and delivery order motivation, if you will. You know, some people believe that agencies should compete with each other to determine which agency should perform, say, a given role in acquisition, notwithstanding
function,
right, notwithstanding, you know, their organic legislation. And others really.
Let's piece that apart. Mm-hmm. So really, what you're saying is that at the time there were folks who thought, well, it's okay if Department of Interior competes with Commerce, who competes with GSA, in providing procurement support, so to speak, to other customer agencies.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, and actually, it wasn't only limited. In my recollection, it wasn't only limited to procurement. It could be other functions of government as well. But for our purposes,
sort of a shared services kind of model, a competitive model.
A competitive model to say, well, if they're doing it better over in Agency X, then let's let Agency X handle it. There were others who sought to improve contract administration flexibility for the government. So you had technological refreshment. You had IT oversight issues at the time. Remember, there were some big, big telco and other contracts. Where they, even though they were IDIQs, and IDIQs are for the government to exercise some kind of flexibility, the government really didn't have the flexibility it wanted. And some thought that the authority was questionable in agencies. You know, I think that was probably more on the defense side. But you can't assume that all the motives were the same, because they weren't.
Well, you're talking like the authority. Some people, you know, there was a split, I guess, in the community, right? That you could or couldn't do multiple award contracts, with DOD sort of, you know, having more of a skeptical view at the time whether you could do multiple award IDIQ type contracting without some authority being.
Yeah, there was a feeling that there was a need for more authority on that side, and then on the civilian side, where I was more on the civilian side, there was concern that there wasn't enough flexibility for the government to achieve, say. Where you had two vendors on an IDIQ, you couldn't get them to transition fast enough. Or if you wanted product 2.0 or version 2.0, if you had a single award, a vendor might not have the same motivation. You offer it out as a task order, and you get somebody else to say, you know, another awardee to say, hey, I would like that. But you had to have it under a limited competition. You would basically have this run as a contract administration activity. And
The task order competition. Right.
Exactly, which was a fair opportunity as opposed to full and open under mm-hmm. CICA. And that's why you, at the time, did not have protest authority for it, because it would just – the thought was it would really start to grind up the system if you start to competing every single task order.
Right. So FOSSA created that multiple award IDI, or, you know, basically cemented a multiple award IDIQ contract authority.
Concept. Yeah. I mean, there was a big telco contract at the time. You know.
Yeah.
Now
FTS 2000 or something like that. Right. Yeah.
Now, if you think about it at that time, so we had the midterm elections change. And, you know, people moved in, people moved out. It was basically a second bite at the procurement apple before the regs were completed on FASM. And you remember we had Federal Acquisition Reform Act and Information Technology Management Reform Act, both of which were combined into one bill.
Called the Clinger-Cohen Act, right?
There you go.
Absolutely. I remember that.
And again, that reinforced that the government should buy commercial off the shelf. It repealed the Brooks Act, firmer. The GSBCA protester, when there was a GSBCA, remember?
What? No, firmer was the Federal Information
Management Form.
Management.
Regulation.
Something. Yeah, I remember the firmer.
And then you had IT procurement authority going back to the agencies. Oversight was vested in OMB. Remember the whole Form 300 mm-hmm. process. And so then we went from multiple award task and delivery order contracts to multiple award, multiple agency. So think of vertical and horizontal,
yes.
If you will. task and delivery or order contracts. Again, these vehicles were, the thinking here was that you wanted to provide channel opportunities for the agencies to buy so they could speed up the process, and you wanted to have channel opportunities for vendors to come in and compete as well. Kleiner-Cohen really focused, I think, on encouraging incremental acquisition.
Yeah, modular contracting.
Remember, which we've been talking about over the last couple of years, yep. And allowed OFPP administrator to conduct pilot programs for resources. That's kind of a top of the waves sort of summary. So you had the implementation of these statutes, then you had 9/11, you had all of a sudden, so we had less procurement people. We started to draw down our procurement officials. We had many, many more procurement activities, many more dollars associated with
the war on terror.
War on terror and things like that. And then, I think we have to acknowledge that we had some issues around how people were contracting.
Right.
And so we had a lot of hearings. We had some questionable practices come up. You have GAO, DCAA, IG reports coming out concerning competition, contracting abuse, poor performance, all sorts of things like that, which, motivated, Congress to
take another look,
right. Under the Service Acquisition Reform Act, and you live that firsthand, and it might be helpful. I think I'd like to know. My impression was that we had really lost count of how many multiple agency task and delivery order contracts we had in max generally. I mean, what was your experience on that?
Well, Tom, I'd be happy to answer that question, but right now we do have to take a break. Okay. When I come back, I'll be talking more to Tom Sisti, Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, about commercial item contracting, contract duplication. That's what I'll be talking about a little bit. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP and our procurement historian of the day. and we've been talking a little
as
history.
I sip water, say that.
Yeah. Well, hey, what's a little humor between friends, right? I guess spilled water. I don't know. And Tom, you had asked me just before the break, what the Sarah panel found with regard to multiple award contracting and the growth of that, the use of that authority. Well, it goes to growth, and I think one of the chief concerns or things that we found is when the Sarah panel was authorized by Congress to, review all procurement regulations and procedures and practices and make recommendations to both Congress and OMB about fixes to enhance use of commercial item contracting, just make the system better overall. And I think the biggest thing we found in, the interagency government-wide contracting arena is that what we didn't know. And we still don't really have a great count on how many of these multiple award IDIQ contracts exist that are multi-agency contracts that are the multiples within agencies for the similar services or products, and just getting a handle on that. And it's of concern because we're finding that it increases costs for both government and industry. It increases bid and proposal costs unnecessarily. It increases contract administration costs across the board. When you don't need to have 10 contracts for the same thing, maybe the right number is 3, depending on there's variations there, but the explosion in the number of contracts is something that I think folks on both government and industry are increasingly focusing on as something that's a cost driver in the system that needs to be addressed.
I think that's right. I think it's a lose-lose ultimately, because the government loses, they have to track and manage, and again, you may have duplicative activities going on in the agencies. It's definitely a cost driver on the private sector side. You know, it's almost like you have to guess which vehicle is going to be the vehicle of choice today. And
the problem is, you can tell me, but you can't really guess. You can't take the chance of not bidding and competing for a contract, because that may be the one where you get locked out of that market. You just can't take that chance. So it's a
well,
right?
That's it. And there's the other subtlety here is that, you know, unlike in, you know, years ago, you don't have robust, you don't necessarily have robust IDIQ minimums.
Right.
So that you could spend a lot of money preparing for a vehicle, and then that vehicle, you know, the thresholds are met relatively quickly, and then the government can move on, and there's no obligation. And
right.
You know, if you do that for a number of different vehicles, it can get very costly.
Right, and I think for small businesses, actually, it's an even bigger challenge, because obviously they're smaller. They have fewer resources,
right.
Their margins are smaller, and they've got to pick wisely the first time.
Yeah.
And if they pick the wrong multi-board contract to be on, something that government decides not to use, you know, there goes their channel into the federal marketplace.
I think it's right.
Yeah. The other thing, you know, just to continue this discussion on what the Sarah panel found, or what one of the things, Sarah panel was looking at best commercial practices and things that should be done. And although we didn't, you know, we looked at, you know, the GSA schedules and looking at a schedule that focused more on task order competitions rather than, you know, some sort of oversight mechanism to ensure pricing. Those kind of things have not actually been fully implemented. The competition piece has, but reducing, you know, government unique burdens in contracts is something that I think there's a great opportunity for government and industry to save a lot of money, and ultimately that benefits the taxpayer by sort of reinvigorating commercial item contracting. I think the last decade we've seen a layering on of additional requirements for commercial item acquisition that reduces the government's access to the latest commercial innovations, because companies aren't going to play. And it also just it reduces competition. Because, again, you're reducing the number of people who want to play in the market, and it increases costs.
Right? Well, I think that's probably true. But, you know, at the same time, you have to acknowledge, I mean, from the government standpoint, certainly from our audit and oversight people standpoint, I mean, there have been problems. And those problems, I think those problems multiply, frankly, when you have a system that's taxed administratively, when it's so burdened with duplication that you may not be able to keep an eye on everything, or when people are working too fast, you know, that kind of thing. So some of the concerns are perfectly legitimate, and we can't discount that. I think that with respect to the schedule,
I agree with you. I mean, it's a question of balance.
Yeah,
and you know, because no matter what you do, the government isn't a commercial buyer, right? It buys differently. That's always going to be the case.
Right.
And there's always going to be some element of oversight. But it's fair to say, or there's going to be government unique requirements. But I think it's fair to say, when do those government unique requirements become counterproductive? And there's a tipping point in terms of access to the latest commercial technologies, and also, you know, basically getting more cost-effective and efficient system. The more you layer on requirements, you know, you mentioned, you used the term, you know, sand in the gears.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we see today. I don't know your view on that.
Well, you know, the thing is, if one of the problems, and I think you guys on the Sarah panel identified this, if one of the problems is that you have a very taxed acquisition force, workforce, because they're lower in numbers and they're higher in workload, if you have a compliance issue, and I don't mean an intentional compliance, even if it's, you know, it doesn't have to be intentional, but if you have a compliance issue, adding more compliance responsibilities because to a taxed workforce doesn't necessarily, you know, fix the problem. It's maybe dealing with the process itself, so that you can assure compliance. And not every compliance problem necessitates a regulatory or legislative response. You know, not in this context, but in another context, there were some famous cases about a decade ago involving ethics, and I was sort of surprised because we had people who were found to have done bad things.
Right, right.
They were prosecuted, they were punished, and yet we still pass laws. But they were found to do those bad things through the operation of law. In other words, the laws worked. Did we need other laws to supplement that?
Right. That's isn't that always the case in a lot of these things?
If one is good, two is better.
Right. You know? Yeah. And you do get that. Yeah. You're actually, I can remember just thinking about this is like, to your exact point. Even when I was government, I was saying, you know, the system worked. They caught the bad
right.
guys. And they punished the bad guys. But now we're going to layer three or four more different requirements on, or new requirements, or duplicative requirements. Why? This system already works.
And I think the pushback might be, well, because we don't know how many people slip through the cracks. But, you know, I mean, when you that is where you have to exercise some perspective and say, okay, what is the likelihood that that happened, given the fact that we had a conga line of people being prosecuted versus, you know, the strain on the system, especially, again, these poor acquisition folks who have a lot of work to do.
Right, and then more and more is being asked of them
mm-hmm.
in terms of the oversight and compliance mm-hmm. and certain reports and that sort of thing. In that regard, when you look at the system, and we're gonna have to take a break in a second here, but I would like to think about when we come back for our last segment, is you know what if you could identify the three biggest challenges for the procurement system going forward, what would those be, Tom? But right now we do have to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with Tom Sisti, Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Sisti. Tom is Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP, and we're talking procurement history 101, so to speak, a little bit about acquisition reform of the 90s, where we are today. And, you know, Tom, this segment, when we took the break, I gave you a challenge to let us know like what you see as the top, you know, challenges facing, you know, our procurement system today. So have at it.
Well, I think we talked about something. But I think it'd be good to focus on some of the good work, I think, that acquisition people do. I think we have to deal with the issues of...
Well, that goes to, I have to agree with you 100%. That goes to the esprit de corps of the acquisition
yes.
workforce. And, you know, the fact their jobs do make a difference in the missions, in the everyday missions of agencies and meeting our citizens' needs and, you know, and again, you know, stewardship of the taxpayers' money.
I think that we also have to deal with delay and duplication that we talked about a little bit. You're almost moving back to a pre-reform sluggishness in the system. And it really goes to looking at, you know, how we're responding to legitimate concerns. I mean, there are important concerns about pricing and such, issues like that. But adding procedural steps may not be the way to address those issues. And I think with respect to commercial contracting generally, you can't have this discussion without really, you know, having sort of a discussion about cybersecurity. You've got to get some sense of clarity around what the cybersecurity process is going to be in government. You know, you have opinions that fall along the spectrum of ideas. Some people go from a perspective of geographic restriction, which, you know, you can't do. I mean, the commercial item supply chain is global. It works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You can't, you know, that genie is out of the bottle, okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then you have others that go from speak from a laissez-faire perspective. Oh, we got it all handled. You know, and then you have others who want a highly regulated perspective or framework put in place. I mean, people need to agree on something so we can move forward with a transparent understanding the rules of the road for commercial lives with respect to cyber. And I think on that issue, you have to recognize that it's not like you're in coming to a conclusion and coming to an understanding on what the rules of the road will be. You're not trying to find a cure for a disease. Because there's never going to be a silver bullet that will just knock out this issue. Cyber threats are very dynamic. So the way we respond to them is going to have to be dynamic
as well.
That's right. It's got to be
evolving over time. Right?
Exactly. It's got to be a process or a system of processes that can evolve as the threats evolve. And we're going to need, in parallel with that, I guess, a set of structures to maximize our resiliency, both the ability to survive and the time, of recovery. So this all has implications for commercial items, I think, as things come up.
Right. Well, it seems to me what you're saying here is that and you see it all the time, it's a lack of certainty. Makes it difficult for people to execute. You can't, if you don't know where we're going, you don't know really how to execute.
And if you're looking at it from the government's perspective.
It's on both sides, right?
Yeah, but they also have, different agencies have different needs on different time schedules. And they're going to exercise their regulatory authority as they can. And you can't blame them. They're out there protecting the country or whatever. They're exercising a mission. Mm-hmm. And they've got to fulfill it in the best way they can. So, clarity here would help.
Yeah. So let me go back to another issue, though. Then you mentioned, you mentioned duplication. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on how that should or could be addressed?
Well, there are a couple of ways. I mean, it may sound sort of Pollyanna-ish.
Okay, sure.
But you've got, if we could get some rationalization of the number, some identification of common terms and conditions that could be combined in a broader sense, in an agency, agency acquisition or across a number of acquisitions, to bring this down. If we had a governor on the process that really could try and take some of the administrative burden out, I think that would help. I think this, one of the unsung heroes in government contracting is the schedules program. We have not necessarily looked at how we can leverage that program. There's a lot of benefit to leveraging the program where appropriate, because it's been around for a long time. The rules are very, very well understood by the community on both sides. And there's a lot of credibility built up in it as a program. It also is deemed compliant with the Competition and Contracting Act. There are ways, I understand there are shortcomings.
Right.
And you've spoken to this, I think. In fact, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on it. There are shortcomings, but they don't require necessarily legislative fixes. We could do them administratively.
Right. And I obviously agree with you violently in the sense that the schedules are an unsung sort of hero in the system. Each year it accounts for approximately $50 billion in procurement dollars going to contractors, by customer agencies, orders under the contracts. We're talking about approximately $10 billion for the VA schedules and about $40 billion of GSA schedules. And that's a program that's, it's because of that dollar volume, it does get a lot of scrutiny. But I don't think it gets a lot of sort of praise, I don't know what the right word, because it does, year after year, customers come back and use it because it's a streamlined, efficient way for them to meet their requirements. And companies invest in being on the schedules because it provides that channel, government-wide channel, to the federal marketplace. I do agree with you there. I think it has great potential that it hasn't been fulfilled at the same time, that their contract structures could be addressed to make the contracts more efficient, effective, to provide complete solutions. I think there's an opportunity to, bring it sort of to the 21st century with regard to its pricing practices and policies, and to leverage systems to make it more efficient across the board for customer agents. I think there's great potential there if they focused on that And that, in turn, would help address, unnecessary duplication of contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
I want to ask you, do we have a consistent year-over-year small business participation rate on the schedules?
Man, am I doing this interview or you, Tom? it's about one-third of the dollars annually go to small businesses under the schedules program, and that sort of demonstrates, that it is a viable program, that small businesses do look to it as a channel to be in the federal marketplace, and that's important. They look at it and they submit offers every day, business day of the year. The schedules are open for potential offers. That's important because you want the latest commercial technology. You want to provide opportunities for small businesses. So, any other questions, Tom?
Sorry.
No, it's okay. But, we've come to the close of the show. I want to thank my guest today, Tom Sisti, Chief Legislative Counsel for SAP. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.